The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
Hey, you're listening to Partially Examined Life. This is episode 138, part 2, where we talked in part 1 to John Searle about his book, Seeing Things as They Are, A Theory of Perception. So in this second half, we're going to give our reactions. We're going to get a little more cash of the fact that the three of us read this whole book. So that interview was a heck of a lot of fun. Do you feel like it was difficult in terms of having the space and relaxation to articulate a view that you're not sure that you know how to articulate? And, you know, the way that we do on this show, I think it's perhaps useful that we have a second half that we can take a little more time with it without having him shout us down for wanting to wash my mouth out.
He's earned it after decades.
Well,
decades of doing this, you get cranky with all the wrong people out there.
I liked his crankiness in that I thought he was very articulate about it. He wasn't sputtering about it. He did say a version of, it's just a bunch of malarkey. I just can't understand. It's almost unfathomable how all these really smart guys were so stupid about this. But he's articulate about his objections.
He happens to be wrong about, in my view.
Well, and we've been critical in the past. I think the comparison to Ayn Rand is directly on point because they had a similar fury about Kant and all the post-Kantians for not the same political reason, obviously, but the same epistemological intuition that, no, of course, come on. Of course we have access to the world directly, and therefore science works in a pretty straightforward way, and there's no room for all this malarkey about religion. That's something that Searle and Ayn Rand very much have in common.
Well, as Searle, you know, admitted, he hasn't carefully read all of these figures, especially the German idealists. It's more of a reaction to the general idea of what these guys represent. It's not a close reading of Descartes and Kant and Hegel and then a systematic rejection or correction of those views. It's a more general zeitgeist of what they represent that he's rejecting.
Well, and it's also he's concerned, all the examples that we talked about were specific perceptions of physical objects. The discussion of Hegel was all about these very high-level abstractions, and that was following very much in the tradition of Aristotle, who himself was giving us a version of idealism where we get, there's the nous, there's mind in itself, apart from my mind, apart from your mind, but that we only end up thinking as the nous when we are thinking about these universal things. So another way to say that is kind of like when you talk about math, just like Frege says it, when you talk about math, when you talk about logic, you don't actually have to talk about the habits of individual minds. You can just talk about the subject matter. That's, to me, the essence of why you would want to talk about nous or something like that, is because you're no longer concerned with individual psychology. You could talk about thought in some broader sense, as Frege does. And, you know, we weren't talking in this discussion except at the very end where I brought up his books on money and society and politics and stuff that I really want to read now. But I don't think they would actually do much in the direction I'm thinking here. You know, we were not talking about abstractions at all. And maybe there is something to be said that when you are discussing something that's more abstract than red, or this particular instance of red, then there might be some sense of talking about spirit or nous or something.
What are you trying to get at?
Just trying to recreate some of our discussion about this in Hegel.
Let's talk about justice or money or any other abstract idea. I mean, I thought that's what he was covering at the end, something that was ontologically subjective.
Right. It only exists because people think about it.
So this is a book about perception, right? Not about the thinkable.
What are we talking about nous? What about talking about justice or abstract ideas makes you want to talk about nous?
I'm kind of asking the question, does it make more sense to feel that there is a need to talk about different perspectives in a wider... Sorry, I'm just trying to compose what the question I have in my head here. Well, I mean, what do you think? Why would idealism be seductive at all?
I tried to say it during the first half, but it's seductive because we seem to have a mediated access to the world. I don't buy his account of the traditional epistemologists, that they somehow thought we can perceive only our own representations, and therefore we have this distance from the world. We have to explain how it is we can know things. If they use the word "we perceive our representations," they're only using that equivocally. It can't be the same as perception in our everyday sense of perception of the world. Because like I said, all the same epistemological problems would just re-arise within that scheme. What they need is the same sort of having awareness of that's immediate, that's non-intentional in this other sense that Searle was describing. But the seductiveness of it is just this idea that we want to say, all of this is motivated by saying, we want to say we have knowledge of the world. And knowledge is something that has to put us in touch with mind-independent objects. There has to be some sort of mind independence to them for the knowledge to be objective. But on the other hand, there has to be some mind dependence because it's a relational thing between our minds and the world. And traditionally, philosophers have been confused about how you can preserve both mind independence and mind dependence, how you get those two things to work together so that we have objective knowledge of the world and yet account for the fact that that comes through our minds. You know, you're just mentioning Hegel. His solution is to say, we got to move back to some stuff that comes before even the subject-object distinction. Let's stop starting from the standpoint of, you know, a subject-object distinction. So, he's going to give his own version in a way of direct realism. It's not one apparently that Searle likes, but it's quite, it's motivated and structurally similar in some ways. So, but anyway, I think that's how you explain the motivation for idealism. And idealism can mean, of course, different things. And the idealist gets sort of a picture, which again is in some ways similar to Searle's, because within that little constructed mind realm, you have direct access to objects, you know, Berkeley.
Yes.
And so, like I said, they're giving up the thing in itself in order to get that direct access. And Searle's rejoinder is, look, you can have both. You can have both the thing in itself and this directness. But that's a puzzle.
But that's Berkeley's view as well, is you end up, it's just he wants to call the thing in itself an idea. And maybe there's no sensible reason to do that. That's kind of what I was getting. Well, why would you want to call it that? Well, if you're Hegel, you would want to call the thing in itself an idea because it's knowable conceptually.
Yeah, but it's the same for Berkeley. We want to call these objects ideas because we want to give them the property of knowability, and it seems like that's the only way to do it, is to call them ideas. They have to be knowable. So the knowable things are the ideas.
Yeah, I understand that, but in the case of Berkeley, there are reasons why he sounds like he's such a fruitcake, is that his approach to that is that, you know, I don't have access to the world. Right, I have access to ideas, and there's some way in which
the ideas are the world. Yeah,
so we do have access to the world.
So someone might come along and say, "Look, you're just using a different word. Why not just call it matter?" And Berkeley actually addresses that. He goes on at length about why. Well, why not just say everything is matter then? And again, it comes down to the fact that when we call something matter, we sort of have subtracted mind from it, and we can't do that on his view.
So in the same way, and I guess this is why Searle doesn't want to call himself not only not an idealist, but he doesn't want to call himself a materialist. He doesn't want to call himself an identity theorist. He just thinks that these conceptual schemes that give rise to this kind of talk are too screwed up in the first place. And another interview I heard him talk about, it's like, well, you know, haven't other philosophers in the past, like Heidegger, tried to come up with new language that avoids the subject? Because the problem does seem to be, well, is his problem the subject-object distinction?
No, I think he embraces that by talking about the subjective realm and the objective. So he's going to embrace that distinction and yet find a way to join. And again, I really actually do think his solution is ingenious, but we'll get to that. But it's, yeah, it's a different sort of approach to try and, yeah, move back to the moment before the subject-object distinction.
Well, I think I not only perceive causality, but I perceive karma. I perceive that that happened to you because you're a bastard.
Yes, the philosopher karma.
Karma, I think he was a chameleon. He comes and goes.
His theory is that you deserve what you get.
So what else did we get out of that? So he gave his little thing about biological naturalism. I know we didn't read more than that one little chapter about his philosophy of mind, but he gives it pretty well. Pretty much that there's a problem in the relation between mind and matter, but it's just, and this seems right to me, that there are different levels of description of the same phenomena. So he is an identity theorist in that sense. It was not clear whether he was a type identity theorist or a token identity theorist. In other words, is it?
So let me just throw the jargon card, because I have no idea what identity theorist means and token and yeah.
Let me just explain it then. I wanted to situate him in this. If you say that each experience of a belief or a desire is identical to a particular brain state, then you're an identity theorist. And so he is. It's the difference between the two is if you're a type identity theorist, then you might say each pain is C fibers firing and it's a particular type. But you might want to say there are different neurological things that could result in the experience of pain. So it could be C fibers firing or it could be this other thing going on. So maybe in that case, you're either just, well, giving a more extensive version of the type, but you're at least saying on a token basis, when any particular occurrence of a pain or any other mental content, then there is some physical thing that is going on underlying it that is the same. Now, there's the question of like, well, what is the same? And he seemed to jump at the only reason somebody would want to be an identity theorist is because you're a reductionist, because you want to get rid of the mental talk and say, once science is advanced enough that we know that pain is C fibers firing, we will just even stop using the word pain. Or if we do, we'll just say, oh, that's just folk psychology. We'll just retain that.
I don't think he would buy that, though. I don't think.
No. He definitely does not. He thinks he was arguing against the situation you were putting forward, Wes, where that's what's going on, where you're just giving a neurological account by saying, no, yeah, you will always need the mental talk. And I can see that from a social perspective. I don't know. It just seems like the physical talk would be too complicated. So it would just take too long to say anything. It's just like, should we say this in binary or should we say it in?
It doesn't convey the same information, but I don't want to, do we really want to have our philosophy of mind debate?
I just wanted to bring it insofar as we brought it in last time. And how does that affect what he had to say about perception and whether you buy it or not?
I mean, I actually like I was a big fan, always a big fan of his take on consciousness. You know, mm-hmm. Especially the Chinese room argument, which I think it's very illustrative, right? So
let's give it quickly. I know we have a whole other episode on it. It's symbol manipulation never amounts to consciousness.
So if you think of it on a linguistic analogy, syntax can never give a rise to semantics. So if you have a language, the rules of the ordering and the structure of that language can never spontaneously give rise to a semantics where one word has one meaning and another word has another. And there's an analogy there to brain processes where you think of the brain functions as syntax, and the puzzle, the mind-body problem, is how syntax there spontaneously gives a rise to its own semantics. The Chinese room argument is just a bunch of people in a room
that have a rule book of when you receive this kind of symbol, output this kind of symbol. The symbols that they're receiving are Chinese characters. And so you feed it Chinese characters and the bunch of people in the room, or maybe it's just one person, end up able, by following the rule book, to give back responses that somebody on the outside thinks that this room is actually speaking Chinese. Yet clearly nobody in the room understands Chinese. So there was a question, well, does the system as a whole understand Chinese? And, you know, no, he doesn't buy that.
So the implication of functionalism is that you could just, as long as you have the right patterns and functions and operations, you could have consciousness. And that could even be, there's talk of, by some philosophers, of suppose you had everyone in China become cogs in a machine where they're behaving in certain ways that it replicates certain brain functions. And does the population of China become suddenly its own, collectively, a conscious entity? That's sort of some of the weird implications of functionalism.
And I think they tried that with the Olympic Games opening ceremonies.
Oh, God. So I brought that up just because those sorts of insights are really, I think, crucial in the history of the philosophy of mind. But I think he's in a minority. His idea is that it's not just the patterning and the functions of the brain that make it conscious, but there's something about the biological substrate itself. There's some property of that little gelatinous thing that contributes to its consciousness, which is not to say that you couldn't have some other substrate. It's just that that substrate, too, would have to have these special properties that give rise to consciousness. It's not enough for the substrate to be arranged in the right way and to function in the right way.
It's a little bit like saying that something about the biology makes us self-active beings. It's nominally Aristotle in that respect, right? It's just a distinction for biological creatures that they're conscious. And that's just part of what they are.
Right. And it's not a philosophical question.
Yeah.
How that happens. It's a scientific neurological question.
And that we have consciousness the way we have four limbs.
Yeah, I don't agree that the problem of consciousness is just simply a scientific question. And I don't, you know, Searle acknowledges the mind-body problem, and he seems to acknowledge in places that it's intractable. But then he says these things in places, well, he wants to embrace naturalism and seems to say there is no problem. So it's unclear even within his own writing what his view on this is. It's contradictory, I think.
I think it has a parallel in the account of perception. You know, what makes something red? Well, it makes something red because it's the kind of thing that makes us see red.
Sure.
There's something lacking as an illustrative explanation.
It's weird. So I call that ingenious, but I also think it's weird. It's something that requires a lot more thought.
Well, but say to me a little bit what's lacking in it, right?
So we say, how does consciousness put us in touch with the things themselves? This is the way I like to think of the question. And then you tell me, well, it puts us in touch with the things themselves because the things themselves are just dispositions to cause certain types of experiences. And experiences are fundamentally attributions of causality to certain subjective, qualitative feelings of things.
Or perceptions.
Well, they're attributions through the subjective, qualitative, but they're attributions to the objective, right?
Yeah, you know, so the intentional aspect of experience is to, you know, you have a certain phenomenology to it, what he calls a phenomenology. There's a feel to it. And then I attribute a causality to that feel to some object that's causing it. And so those are the two aspects, the two really important aspects of that experience, the qualitative feel of it, and then the attribution of causality. And then so the question is, well, what is that having an awareness of an experience, the having of the experience, not, you know, not the perception of a representation, which he rejects, but simply mm-hmm. the having of an experience. How does that get me in touch with the object? How does the intentionality actually hook me up to the object that's causing the experience? And
well, I thought that was how intentionality is working in the first place.
But he wants to explain intentionality. He wants to reduce it to this non-intentional internal relation between experience and the world. He wants to say why there's intentionality, essentially. And his answer is the reason why that can be intentional is because when I have that qualitative feel and represent it as caused by the object that my intention reaches out towards, its nature is to be the kind of thing that causes that kind of experience. And so that gives me the direct contact because my ascription of causality matches up precisely with its being a causer. I don't know how to explain it better than that, but
no, that sounds like his explanation.
So I'm feeling a little guilty about our glib use of intentionality, that I know that we explained it. We tried to explain it during the discussion with Searle, but we've had so many discussions of it within our episodes, and it always means something slightly different that maybe we should back up and kind of say what that is, that the intentionality is just the aboutness of a mental state or
yeah,
even a sentence. His whole book, Intentionality, is primarily not about perception. It's about beliefs. It's about sentences. It's about propositions.
Right. It's a minority position in the philosophical world to think of perception as intentional.
But the minority position is what we've talked about most, which started with maybe Brentano or somebody, but it definitely was in Husserl and other folks like that, which is every mental act, a perception, a belief, maybe not everyone, you might have like just dread, not of anything in particular, but usually it's of something. And so what do you call that something? You could call it the intentional object, the intentional content. With Husserl, it was the act is the noesis and the object is the noema, just to throw out some obnoxious terms like that. In some ways, you might say it's indivisible, that the intentional act is, this is why Husserl uses those terms. It's just the kind of poles of it, but it's really one thing. You can't think of...
With Husserl, the intentional objects are abstract, right? The answer is yes.
I'm not sure about that. Some of them, I thought.
Now, because the phenomena are always these partial experiences of the object, right? We have this temporal sequence of different aspects of the object, and the intentional object itself is the object. And so it has to be abstract on this view.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
But the example he gives, so on page 14, and he gives a pretty cursory description of it, but it's, you know, the mind is directed at about of objects or states of affairs in the world, whether it's hunger, thirst, beliefs, perceptions, intentions, desires. They have that directedness towards the world. And so when we talk about conditions of satisfaction, so he says the content of the intentional state determines its conditions of satisfaction. So, which is to say the content of the belief that it is raining is satisfied if and only if it is raining. So the conditions of satisfaction are the objects or states of affairs. And I represent those conditions to myself, you know, in this case with a belief. I say, hey, it's raining, and I represent the condition of satisfaction, meaning my belief that it's raining is only going to be true if, in fact, it's raining. So that gets us at some of that jargon. So the intentionality there is this sense in which, in the case of beliefs, the truth or falsity of the intentional state depends on the world outside of us.
And just the fact that you're putting it as that intentional state has a truth or falsity is in line with the way Searle talks about it, which is that actually you don't just have an intentional object. In other words, I perceive the fish. Yeah. It's always, I perceive that the fish is here.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's always a state of affairs, really, that you're trying to connect up to.
I thought he was trying to articulate Searle's view.
Yeah, because he wants to say with perception, he wants to solve the problem of hallucination and illusion by saying that we can have an intentional content, but mm-hmm. that fails to
have its conditions of satisfaction satisfied.
Yeah. So this has puzzled philosophers for a long time because there was the belief that, you know, an intentional state must have an object of some kind, even if it's a non-existent object, you know, even when we're hallucinating.
Or in fact, you would have these discussions about if I'm imagining a unicorn, the unicorn doesn't really exist, but because I'm imagining it, there must be a way in which it exists in some fashion.
Right.
It exists as an idea. It subsists.
But also it just, we can put it in this realm of abstract entities. When we hallucinate, we have content without the satisfaction.
Or even when we don't hallucinate, right? Like in the case of the unicorn, we just make up a story, right? Any kind of fictional story would be in that realm, right? Where you have content that the conditions of satisfaction are never met, right?
I was thinking specifically of perception.
Yeah, so there would be maybe a different discussion to have. So he would reject the notion that when I read Harry Potter that I'm having perceptions.
Right.
Right? Or maybe we could ask how he would talk about that, because I'm going to have something playing through my mind. I'm going to have images. I'm going to be having thoughts and thinking about it. But he's not going to consider those perceptions in a conventional way. And this might be, you know, another way of articulating why you would have something like the bad argument or have confusion about this, is that we have thoughts about the world that are very much like the kinds of things that we engage in when we're interacting with the world, right? Now, he contends that they're just simply not the same. Whatever I'm imagining when I'm reading Harry Potter, it is not the same thing as if I were Harry Potter interacting with the world. Let's pick something that was true. It was a documentary. My reading a book about being in Syria is not the same thing as being in Syria.
Even if you have a very vivid exactly. imagination, yes. And his account of that is because in the imagining case, it doesn't have intentional causality. You perceive it as something that you are generating the image of, not that the being in Syria is generating that
That's
image.
That's right.
Right. Imagination lacks key features of intentionality.
Yes. In particular, the self-reflexive causality.
Yeah.
Say what the self-reflexive part is. That's the first time we've uttered that term here.
That just means that it is assigning the causality to the object. So when I see the ball rolling down the street, I have expectations about that.
Yeah. So part of my intention is not just that I say to myself, oh, there's a ball rolling down the street. Part of the intention is to say to myself, and that ball rolling down the street is causing this experience. So that if there actually isn't a ball rolling down the street, then the intention isn't satisfied.
Yeah. I was going down the road of predicting something about its motion and stuff like that. But Wes, you're right that that's the self-reflexive part has to do with that red ball is the thing that's causing my experience.
Right. And there has to be a hookup with the actual content and the object that it's about in the right way. So that he says, even if you had, let's say you're really a brain in a vat, but a ball rolling down the street hits your vat and causes by bouncing your brain in your vat, somehow that causes the experience of seeing a ball rolling down the street. That's not in the right way.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
All right, let's take a second and bring on Seth to talk about the sponsors.
Like so many of you, we love to learn for our own personal enrichment, and that's why we do the Partially Examined Life. Now, we've been talking quite a bit over the past year or so about the Great Courses, and we want to highlight their new video learning service, the Great Courses Plus. Through the Great Courses Plus, you can get unlimited access to a huge library of lecture series in many topics, including philosophy, history, music, mindfulness, and much more, taught by top professors. We really want you to try the Great Courses Plus, so they're giving our listeners a special chance to watch their popular course, The Great Ideas of Philosophy, as well as hundreds of other courses, absolutely free. The Great Ideas of Philosophy is taught by Professor Daniel Robinson. Now, in honor of the John Searle episode that we're currently doing on perception and, relatedly, his philosophy of mind, I checked out Lecture 54 from Dr. Robinson, which is called Philosophy of Mind, If There Is One. He does, as usual, his terrific job of laying out the challenges of both dualism and monism, as well as theory of representation and setting up the questions that it causes, which are relevant to what John Searle is trying to solve. Now, with the Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want, anytime and anywhere. Now, right now, the Great Courses Plus is offering our listeners a chance to stream hundreds of their courses, including the Great Ideas of Philosophy, which is a $530 value, for free when you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. The MIT Press, today's sponsor, has just published a new book by Aaron Schuster called The Trouble with Pleasure. The book is an investigation into the strange and troublesome relationship to pleasure that defines the human being, drawing on the disparate perspectives of Deleuze and Lacan. Joan Kupchak has called it a robust, fascinating, and humorous account of the paradoxes of the pleasure. A truly original and important work. Schuster offers his own engaging and surprising conceptual analysis and inventive examples. He provides a philosophy of complaining, ranging from Freud's theory of neuroses to Spinoza's intellectual complaint of God. He elaborates on, among other things, a theory of love as mutually compatible symptoms, an original philosophical history of pleasure, including a hypothetical Heideggerian treatise and a Platonic theory of true pleasure, and an exploration of the 1920s literature of the death drive, including Thomas Mann, Italo Svevo, and Blaise Cendrars. Read more about this book and a few new philosophy titles on Heidegger's Black Notebooks, Free Will and Paradox among them at mitpress.com/PEL. That's mitpress.com/PEL.
Even if we just took the straight up brain in a vat case, your brain was stimulated in such a way that you had all of the neurochemical experiences of seeing a ball rolling down the street. He would say that you had that ontologically subjective experience, but that it didn't match up with the world because it didn't actually happen. And so you were just wrong.
But yet he has to say that somehow, that it's not that you had the representation of a ball and it just so happened that it wasn't instantiated. He has to somehow say,
it doesn't meet the conditions of satisfaction.
You're grasping at the... This is the really frustrating thing throughout this whole book, is he wants to say there's no intermediary between you and the world. And he actually gives, we did not talk about this, he at one point talks about one of the characteristics of these disjunctivists. He has a whole chapter about these disjunctivists, some of his contemporaries, who Alva Noe is one of them, that is a name that we hear thrown around a lot, that are sort of more thorough direct realists than he is. And this is like what we said about Sartre, is that all perception is an openness to the world.
That the object is actually literally part of the experience.
Yeah.
Yes. Not incidentally, I've been thinking about us reading William James' essays in Radical Empiricism, and that is exactly that view back in 1910 or something.
But he criticizes the disjunctivists because they reject the notion that you can actually have a hallucination that is the same as the actual experience. Mm-hmm. And so their take on the problem that he's addressing is that there really is no proper identity between a brain in a vat and experiencing the real world, that you could always make that distinction. Searle doesn't want to grant that. He wants to grant that the experiences of your brain in the vat would be subjectively equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way that you distinguish them is not Well, in fact, in a way, we didn't get into a discussion about this question of judging the conditions of satisfaction, because at some point that's going to happen, right? And so you are going to say, okay, we know that it's veridical if it meets the conditions of satisfaction. And there's this sort of open question about the process of meeting those conditions.
In other words, you could always be wrong.
Yes, yes, exactly.
You could always be wrong. In the case, I think that's what he would say about the brain in the vat case, right?
Yep.
Is that you just don't have any way of knowing.
Exactly.
Whereas a lot of these guys want to say, by definition, so for instance, as a pragmatic point, if we are brains in vats, if we are in the matrix, whatever, if that's what reality is, as long as it exhibits the appropriate characteristics of reality, in other words, you can't, like in the Matrix, bend spoons or whatever, you can't bend reality, you can't cheat, you can't tweak the code, then that's what reality is by definition.
The Matrix is a great example of this, right? Because in the Matrix, most of the entities in the Matrix don't have any understanding that they are in a Matrix, right? And it's only through certain kinds of deviations that identify that you are in it. And, you know, Neo eventually is both made aware of it by someone clarifying for him some weird senses that he had earlier, which we aren't really privy to in the story. And then it becomes very clear to him that there is this distinction between the Matrix and not the Matrix by being able to see signs of it and manipulate it and stuff like that, which sounds to me very much like that account of it Searle would be perfectly fine with. To the extent that you figure out that you are a brain in a vat requires that there be events that allow you to make that distinction. And otherwise, you don't have any way of making the distinction. It's just not possible. And that would be true about anything in the world, right? The only way that you know whether something is true is having it satisfy conditions of satisfaction. And that, in fact, it could be that those conditions of satisfaction are met in a way by there being a completely different...
They seem to be satisfied, but they're not.
But they're not, yes.
Because the Matrix, because this is all conceivable, because he doesn't rule it out, then it does seem... He's giving a kind of pragmatism. He's saying that...
Exactly. It's exactly right.
Our practices assume the existence of an objective world.
Yep.
And so unless there's a strong reason to go against that, then that's what we should believe.
Well, and in fact, he's deeply pragmatic in this respect.
And it seemed to be the same thing. You know, we were pointing out how he's giving a version of aspectualism. He's saying we see something that is true about objects, something that is true of the things in themselves, but maybe it's not the whole truth. And of course, in a trivial sense, it's never the whole truth, even if, you know, the ultimate constituents are atoms. There's not even subatomic particles, atoms. And maybe we even have microscopes that can detect the atoms. Even then, because just the sheer number of atoms, we wouldn't know all the details. But that's not the point we're making. There could be whole realms of explanation that we just aren't thinking about and couldn't possibly think about. And they're way beyond anything that we could possibly even imagine because, you know, reality is not actually three-dimensional or is not actually space-time structured that way. That's something that's introduced by our perceptual faculties per Kant. And so what's really important, I was trying to just bring in something like the Vedic view, you know, that the world is the veil of Maya. It's all illusion. Because Wes brought up Schopenhauer, who shares this. And so that, yes, you could do science, you could have objectivity, you could have all that. But even though your perceptions are getting at some aspect of reality, it's not getting at the most important ones. But according to Searle, at least, pragmatic considerations, you know, and I agree with this. I don't think that we have a reason to think that really everything is an illusion and Buddhism is right and we're all subject to the veil of Maya. I just don't. I don't find that motivating. And I think that's kind of where he's coming from, that he's...
Yeah, but Schopenhauer, you know, says we have direct access to the things in themselves through causality. It's a very similar picture in its broad brushstrokes.
Yeah, I would have to go back to Schopenhauer to try to line up that part of Schopenhauer with the world of illusion, you know, sort of the tip of the iceberg.
Well, can I just give a brief...
Yeah, please do. I just don't remember it.
So Searle, in quite a few places, says, look, the best way to understand our experience of objects via intentionality is to look at the other side of the coin where we have actions caused by our intentions. And then to look at that, you know, what he calls the world to mind fit there and see that as reversed in the case of experience where the mind is fitting to the world. And Schopenhauer does the same thing. He says, look, what we know best is causality through our own will. We know it because when we will things, when we intend things, we have direct access to that. And each action, right, there are two sides to it. One is the representational side of the moving of my body, and the other is the subjective side of having that intention. And that's the loophole that gets us access to things in themselves, the things in themselves behind the representations. Because what we can do is we can identify, because everything out there, all representation is just a manifestation of the internal striving of things. It's the manifestation of their causal intentionality, let's say, in a broad sense. And so the reason why we can have direct access to them is just because as willing beings, we get direct access to all those willings outside of us. So now compare Searle's position, in which the thing that gets us access to the object is the fact that the object consists of the disposition to cause, almost like the willing or striving in Schopenhauer, consists of the disposition to cause, and we can represent it as cause to us. So in other words, we don't need to get into all this fancy stuff about, oh, here's a representation and it pictures the object, and we have to figure out how it frigging pictures the object. It's a mess. It's so much simpler to say all we need is to say, oh, here's my qualitative feel. What makes it connect with the world is not that that qualitative experience is like the world, but simply that I say that that qualitative feel is caused by the world, and the world just is the disposition to cause that kind of qualitative feel. If that's not Schopenhauerian.
The way you described Schopenhauer's account of how we know causation because it's our action, actually, Searle has exactly that same thing. I followed his directive. The book was mostly self-contained, but he makes several references. I didn't quite get this intentional causation stuff. And so I do own the 1983 book Intentionality and read a good chunk of chapter 4 on intentional causation. And I'm not cheating here by going beyond, but I'm just confirming what you just said, which is that whether or not this is how we learn about causation, that's not really the point. It's how could we justify our belief in causation? That he was saying that Hume is so wrong. In fact, every perception that we have is causally laden. And he sees perception throughout the book that we read, perception and intention in action is what he calls it, are kind of two sides of the same coin. That the only difference is one has a mind to world fit. In other words, I'm trying to make my perception accurately reflect the world, and one has a world to mind fit. In other words, I want to do something. I want something to happen. And so I'm trying to make the world accord to my intention that I already have. And that's confusing because intention in that way means what it normally does to a non-philosopher, meaning to do something.
But he thinks those two things are connected. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. That intentions in the ordinary sense, motivations, are just one species of intentionality. Broadly, directedness.
Well, in other words, an intention in the typical sense is this, you know, I'm going to make the world satisfy this conception, right? I conceive of it and I'm going to do it. I'm going to transform the world into to make it fit this intention. And then our experience of objects is just the reverse of that. You know, the object causes me to have the intention that it satisfies, something like that.
Yes. Yeah. It causes that picture of the world for you.
And built into the notion of self-motivated causality, I don't know a good way to, intention sub A, in other words, the ordinary version of causality, I intend to do something. Built into that is a notion of causality just between things in the world, even that don't involve me. Because if I want to break this vase with this hammer, that's something that I can experience. Then part of that is, yes, my experience of my will as moving the hammer and my will is causing the vase ultimately to break. But it also is a perception of the interaction between the hammer and the vase. Even, you know, after I've sort of done my thing, maybe I drop the hammer and what does it do to the vase? So that's enough to get it going to then have the idea of causality inhabits the whole world.
I know that causality outside of me is real because I have this internal window into causality through my own causally directed intentional behaviors.
But wasn't it weirder in Schopenhauer that it's like we have to be empathetic to what it's like to be the vase or what it's like to be the hammer, whereas Searle's does not have that issue. It's not so weird.
Well, and he also puts it in the language of willing, right? And so you end up having every entity or proto-entity or whatever has its own activity in which it's willing things. And that sounds weird.
The idea still is, though, that my direct access to the world is access to the causality of things. And I think that is quite similar between Schopenhauer and Searle.
I think you're right. And in fact, you see it in the intentionality of what Marx said of trying to break the vase. But then you also have the world reflecting back on you, particularly when your intentionality is retuned by the world. So you grab a hammer to go to break the vase, but it turns out the vase is actually made of concrete and the hammer bounces off of it and smacks you in the head, right? And so the world is re-educating your intention.
Hmm. Anything else that struck you from the book?
I really enjoyed the book, and he followed through with his theory of perception in the middle. I think that I would have liked to have spent more time on him resolving or talking about some of these conditions of satisfaction questions, which I think are close to the root of why you would have the bad argument. And why you would have a lot of the things that he just dismisses as crazy town in philosophy have to do with trying to address questions like not just illusion, but making mistakes, making revisions, having conditions of satisfaction, and then finding out that those were the wrong conditions of satisfaction. The whole process of figuring things out that give rise to a notion of mediatedness, that we look at the world through a lens of thoughts and conceptions that are the background. And so he talks about that. In some ways, he addresses a whole host of really interesting pieces, but I wanted the next book too, because I think that some of the really hard questions, which he admits are hard questions, he doesn't spend as much time with.
I was trying to find reviews of this online.
Yeah, I looked them up too.
And like, for instance, one of them just was calling into question this terminology that he comes up with of the subjective visual field versus the objective visual field. I kind of like it, but there's something a little weird about it. And it would be strange if, of all the many philosophers that have thought of this throughout history, that he's the only one that came up with this sort of solution. That's why I just see his solution as one of many variations that we've seen in the literature of, yes, of course, there's some intermediary between you and the things. It's just that his intermediary, he wants to be very careful that it's not really an intermediary. It's an activity. It's a doing. But at the same time, he criticizes more thoroughgoing direct realists who, in giving an account of the ontology of the situation, will just say, well, there's me and there's the things that I'm perceiving. Because you need in the ontology there the perception itself. You know, he accuses these people of denying that consciousness even exists. Right. If they say, well, what perception really is something that physically includes the object. In other words, what perception is just like when we talk about money, we're kind of stating a social fiction. We're stating something that is not actually coextensive. It's not token-token equivalent with a brain state. That talking about a perception is actually not talking about a psychological thing, strictly speaking, at all. It's talking about a social phenomena, something that is a relation between you and things. And just Searle has no tolerance for that. It just makes me want to read one of those guys like Alvin Noe or something to see really what this kind of view looks like. Because like Ayn Rand, Searle is so dismissive of his many opponents. You know, just his characterization of the whole history of philosophy is making this very fundamental mistake. You know, either they're denying consciousness exists. That's not the bad mistake. This is the other thing I was referring to. Or the bad mistake.
The bad argument.
The bad argument. That all we know is our own minds. No, as you were saying, Wes, that's not an appropriate characterization probably of most of the people that, for reasons of the argument of illusion, think that there have to be some intermediary between you and things.
Right. They just want to say experience is mediated. Kant, in a sense, says all you know is your own mind. Not Descartes, right? Descartes says you know objects outside of you and so on. They're grounding it in different ways, that's all. He's performing the same sort of task. He just doesn't want to do it with representation, with typical correspondence theory of truth or something like that. I was a little put off by all the glib rejections of the history of philosophy, but his solution, I think, is actually unique as far as I know. I mean, it's not typical direct realism. It's, Mark, as you were saying, that these more radical direct realists would probably see him as just another guy who's trying to say there's this intermediary between us and the objects. The only figure I see that's actually really similar to it is Schopenhauer. As far as I can tell, it's really innovative, and it's something I want to give a lot more thought to.
And again, there's this question for me that I'm having a lot of trouble articulating, that clearly he has multiple books on these higher level, more abstract social things. But I get the feeling, like when we read the hermeneutics, Gadamer and them talking about hermeneutics, and all that came right out of people like Nietzsche, which came out of kind of like Schopenhauer. And those guys, they seem to have things that would socially affect your point of view. You know, my distinguishing this from that in a different way than you might, the background knowledge that comes to that, that there's epistemological significance to that in a way that's hard for me to capture through Searle's picture of, oh, well, it's just the kind of thing that causes that kind of perception. And he admits that this is a hole in his own account, in that he says, of course, I perceive this as this kind of Porsche that is my car, not just as red outline. And then somehow in my conscious mind, I build up. No, he's a gestalt guy in terms of we experience complex holes, but he can't relate those complex holes himself to the basic intentional causality that you say, every time I see a Porsche, it's because I'm just assuming that the kind of object that is causing this is the kind that makes me think it's a Porsche. Can you do that with complex stuff? Can you still do the formula?
Well, I think you have to reduce it, don't you? You have to analyze it into the more basic perceptions.
I'm not sure. Like, it seems like he says both in different places, that in some sense, yes, to explain why you could be wrong that it's a Porsche, then you'd have to say, well, no, I did experience, you know, the outline and the colors and stuff. It's just I had an independent categorization in my head from past experiences that I wasn't applying correctly or something like that. This is sort of the higher level stuff that when Kant or somebody does epistemology, yes, you talk about the sensations, but then you also talk about applying these overall categories. And this was entirely what our reading of Hegel was consumed with. And I don't know how Searle can bring in that sort of complexity into his picture. Evidently, he thinks he can.
Maybe that's one of the other four books he's writing.
Well, he admits in the book, and he admitted in our interview, that he hasn't worked that out.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be unsatisfying if we do read his books about society. But I know when I'm thinking about white privilege, then I'm just thinking about the things in the world that connote the idea of white privilege in me. And that's why we're going to be next turning to Bell Hooks, Ain't I a Woman, from 1981, and probably something else by her. If you want an exact reading selection, check out our new page, partiallyexaminedlife.com/upcoming. We're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution.
Big donors since last time have included Colin Negrich, Paul Telson, Aaron Berry, Yehul Degur, Michael Shillman, Joseph Rausos, Paul Post, Mitsuyuki Tokeshi, Sergio Lemaitre, Sean Dvorak, Leary Michael, Joe Robertson, Brandon Mitchell, Dot Tran, Benoit Dagnold Pepin, Wayne Schroeder, Tim Hobbs, Matthew Harrington, Robert Nolan, David McCracken, Mike Herrera, Arthur Rucker, Benjamin Kroc, Jeffrey Hackard, Alexander Park, Ryan Manhire, Justin Jenkins, Clive Bale, Kenneth Joyner, Zvonimir Petakovic, Jeff Stream, Matt Falkowski, Mikhail Mikertichian, Peter Golem, Philip Baker, Roman Mankowski, Theodore Brooks, Lucas Anderson, Kyle Sands, Rico Page, Vincent Urban, Daniel Horn, Omar Gaffar, Jeremy Nam, Chad Thurman, and Adam Y.
And thanks also to the many $5 a month Partially Examined Life citizens. You're awesome.
Yeah, you are.
Follow us on Twitter, discuss with us on Facebook, subscribe to the blog, go subscribe to Nakedly Examined Music at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or other podcasts. Thank you guys for helping me to interrogate our entertaining guest. And I should say, we're going to have two more of these kind of entertaining guests. I won't reveal the names because maybe they'll cancel. But before the end of summer, we have two more of these big name guests, and then we'll be on the map. I thought it was hilarious that Searle did not know what a podcast was, apparently.
Really?
Based on the comments that he was making to Gordon as we were setting up. Yeah, it's like, what is this? What? The picture? What? How could I hear this event? Like, maybe it's just because he's the age that he is. But I think no matter how big we get in the world of philosophy, the big name philosophers of the world are older than we are, are older than that whole world.
I think they just don't pay attention to us.
No, so we have to individually get each of them.
It's okay.
In our little, okay. That would take forever. But hopefully there aren't that many world famous philosophers like John Searle. Do you think regular people, they didn't. But he's one of them. Take our word for it.
He's as famous as you get as a living philosopher.
And we caught him. We didn't catch Putnam. We missed him. But we Putnam caught this died. Guy. He when? Did.
He died less than a month ago. I just found out today that we did miss Merle Haggard.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.